You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. But not tonight again. As we do each after each season, we now go into one of the movies, or as Austin Powers might say, movie. Did I say that right?
No, but it's okay.
He doesn't like Austin Powers, guys. Tonight, we're going to be discussing Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, because Admiral Derpy Whale's here. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
Oh, and I'm James from London.
And so, James, you looking forward to this?
Yes. Now, as whenever we speak, I always tell you that you need to get a new host. It's going to be more critical. And the thing is, I do know that there are some people that don't particularly like Voyage Home. It is an odd film, right? It is, you know, it starts off with 20 minutes of Trek before they then go into a, 1980s movie set on Earth for some reason. But I don't know, I feel that, like, it works somehow. So I am looking forward to it. It also, there's, you know how some people claim that, you know, Star Trek 2, 3, and 4 is the Genesis trilogy?
Yeah.
So you have the three films that you can watch back to back. If there's ever a case of three more weird and wonderful and strange, you know, eclectic mix of films within a single kind of, you know, within a single universe, I haven't found them, because in particular this one, how it just takes a right swerve off into the comedy and to the light fun part of the world. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Okay, so let's say you wanted to spend the day watching Star Trek movies, and because you like the old crew.
Yep.
Where do you start? One or two? I think we talked about this on the last one, too. I don't remember what we said, though.
Okay, well, the first thing is that it's been at least 20 years, I'm going to claim, that that I've been able to watch kind of go, hey, I've got 8 hours to watch Star Trek movies today. That doesn't happen anymore. I mean, I hope I live long enough to be able to retire, or, you know, have a bad enough illness that I have to spend significant time in hospital where I can sit down and watch back-to-back Star Trek. But, do you know, I don't think I've seen back-to-back Trek films in a long time. Let me tell you a story. You probably don't know this, but when they put out Star Trek Generations, when was that? Around 1994 or something like that? Maybe a little later, I don't know.
Not sure. But
around that time, I remember that, you know, it was, I mean, I don't think Star Trek was that popular here, to be honest, but the local cinema where I was living at the time, in Brighton, they had a Star Trek movie marathon. So on the first weekend, you'd come in and you'd watch motion picture through to Voyage Home.
Mm.
And then on the second weekend, you'd watch Final Frontier, Undiscovered Country, and Generations. And Generations would premiere at, you know, midnight or whatever it would be. So I actually think that's the last time I saw them. That's the only time I believe that I've ever seen them kind of in a run. So I technically did do 1, 2, 3, and 4 in a sit-in.
Hmm, okay. All right, because I generally start at 2 because I don't want to get too discouraged. I can't do it.
But okay, anyway.
So let's see here. Go back here. The synopsis for tonight's movie is Admiral James T. Kirk is prepared to take consequences for rescuing Spock and stealing and then losing Starship Enterprise, but a new danger has put Earth itself into jeopardy. Kirk and his crew must travel back in time in an old Klingon bird of prey to right an ancient wrong in the hopes of saving Earth and the Federation from certain doom. And I'm not sure why, but it has another synopsis that says a catastrophe in the future can only be averted by a journey into Earth's past. Cool. Nice.
I do have to say, I like the idea that, clearly within this, collection of three films, first Kirk had to battle, Khan, then he had to battle the Klingon Empire and an exploding planet. And then just when you think no one can top that, it's the probe and the whale that comes along and says, right, this is evil's final form that's going to come and take the Federation. I bet no one saw that coming, right? No one got to the end of Search for Spock and thought, do you know what? I reckon that teasing that the next installment of these series of films is going to be about whales.
Well, didn't they? Am I correct at one point they were already in production of the whales before Search for Spock even came out? Which is why don't they have the teaser at the end of what was to come?
I'm not aware of this teaser at the end of what? Teaser at the end of Search for Spock?
Yeah.
No, not aware of that.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, on the copy of the film that I watched, there is a bumper at the front that basically recaps Wrath of Khan and Search for Spock before you watch Voyage Home. And I never worked out whether that was put on there for the DVD releases or whether it was originally part of the thing that they put in front of the film. I didn't see this until into the 90s, so I don't know.
Okay. All right, so anyway, this screenplay was by Steve Meerson, Peter Krakes, Harve Bennett, Nicholas Meyer, story by Leonard Nimoy and Harve Bennett, directed by Leonard Nimoy, and produced by Harve Bennett. And like you said, this is a Project Genesis arc 3 of 3, I guess you could call it that. Okay, so let's see. William Shatner as Kirk, Leonard Nimoy as Spock, DeForest Kelly as McCoy, James Doohan as Scotty, George Takei as Sulu, Walter Koenig as Chekhov, Nichelle Nichols as Uhura. Then we have Jane Wyatt playing Spock's mama, Amanda. Catherine Hicks as Dr. Jillian Taylor. Mark Leonard as Sarek, Robin Curtis as Savick, Robert Ehrlichstein as the Federation Council President, John Schuch as a Klingon Ambassador, Brock Peters as Ben Sisko's father, otherwise known as Admiral Cartwright, Michael Snyder as a Communications Officer, Michael Berryman as a Starfleet Display Officer. Let me find a little more important people here.
No, I think that's all the important people.
Well, we do have
a parallel list.
Major Barrett is a Commander Chapel. Got him.
Hang on, I completely missed. Where's
Grace Lee Whitney as Commander Rand?
Hang on, where's so? Okay,
so yeah,
it's Rand's in Space Dock, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and is Chapel in Space Dock as well?
I'm not 100% sure.
Well, they must be, because they can't have been.
Yeah, they weren't.
But they're obviously not on. They're not on the Bird of Prey. Correct. But I didn't notice them.
And let's not forget Eve Smith, who got a new kidney, who grew a new kidney. She just is elderly patient. I'm sure she loved that. Look, I'm elderly patient. I got a new kidney. I'm elderly patient. Anyway, then we have Jeff Lester as the FBI agent.
He was good.
Yeah. You mess with me and you're through. You're
yeah. I am? Can I leave now? So, I mean, that's quite a... Oh, don't forget the punk on the bus. Kirk Thatcher. The punk on the bus. Oh, and you can't also forget about the jogger. Let's see. I thought there were two joggers, but it only shows...
Yeah, there are at least two joggers. At least two.
Yeah, James Menges as one of the joggers. Let's see here. Oh, Melanie does that say Melanie Shatner? As an uncredited jogger? Shatner? Melanie Shatner?
I have no idea. Possibly.
I'm probably going to piss off quite a few people, but does William Shatner have a daughter named Melanie?
I know he has a daughter, and in particular, the reason why I know he has a daughter is that the special edition of Star Trek V, when they were reissuing them all on a DVD a couple of years ago, but of course that's not correct. It's like in 91 or whenever it was. So a couple of decades ago, when they were putting together the home releases of these on DVD for the first time, I think, they had a whole lot of special editions with director's commentary. And I know specifically that William Shatner's director's commentary wasn't with, you know, other people he had worked with or other people that could kind of critically review the, you know, Star Trek V. But he actually had his daughter on.
Hmm.
But I don't recall the name.
Okay, well, then we have Stephen Liska as Torg, Anthony Sacco as the uncredited cop on the motorcycle. And I'm trying to think, was he an actual cop? No, maybe not. Okay. Layla Sarakatlo as a passerby. And then we have the wonderful...
Beautiful moments, all of them.
Oh, wow. Then we have the wonderful Madge Sinclair as Geordi's mom. Or the Saratoga captain.
Oh, the Saratoga captain. Yes, because this is the first occasion where we have a female captain of a ship.
Yeah, and if I
remember, also the first black captain of the ship as well, of course.
Uh-huh. And if I remember, I'm trying to verify this before I said it, but I believe she was on Trapper John M.D. Yes, she was Trapper John M.D., which I'm sure you've never heard of before.
No idea what you're talking about.
Yeah. Then we have Philip Wheatland as a uncredited tourist.
That was my favorite moment.
Yeah. So. Oh! Oh my goodness. Why did I almost forget these? Viola Kate Stimson as a lady in the tour. And then we have the garbage men. Phil Rubenstein and John Miranda. Did you see anything? No, neither did you, so shut up.
No doubt highlights of their career.
Absolutely. Yes. So that's pretty much all I can come up with. At least that I can think of.
I think we've digged deep enough.
Sure.
If I could be so bold.
Yes. So what do we think of this movie? I love it. I like it. I don't like the Greenpeace greenkeeping save the world by doing this stuff. However, I do agree with it. I hate to see anything become extinct. Except for mosquitoes. I'd love to see those just disappear from the world forever.
Okay, and what happens in 400 years' time when the big mosquito probe comes up and starts going, "Mosquito, you there? You there? You there? You there? You there?" And with no one replying, ionizes the atmosphere. I mean, Lou, did you learn nothing from watching The Voyage Home?
Yeah, that is very possible. Then I guess, you know, we'll have to go back in time to get some mosquitoes. But here's the deal. I mean, do you think the probe will be of the West Nile type or just a straight probe? Because we kind of got to know which to go back in time for. The one with the West Nile virus or the one that doesn't carry the West Nile virus?
I'm not sure. I mean, it is a hypothetical question at its core, so I'm not entirely sure.
I love it when people say, just be serious, come on. And then I say, well, yes, we're talking about Star Trek. You know, it's not real either. So, well, there's no reason to be serious. But anyway, no, this after the first three movies, it is time to slow down and let's not take ourselves so serious. So I like the idea. I do want to find out where that pizza place was. I don't know if it was real or if it was a stage and they made a pizza place. But boy, I'd sure love to have, you know, tried some of that. What about you, Deck?
Okay. So I know that a fair number of people kind of moan about this film just for being not really Star Trek. But in a way, I think there is first of all, there is a certain campiness about it. Them going, you know, back in time, fish out of water stuff. But they've actually kind of done that before, and they've done it since as well. You know, whenever we see, well, we're about to come up, or at the end of season five, we're going to come up on Time's Arrow, where they also go back in time, and all the fun that they have there with, you know, with Data being a Frenchman. Is that then? Either that or he's from.
No, he was a Frenchman.
In that one, he's a Frenchman. I really like this episode now. Sorry, this episode, this movie. It's not without its flaws. It has certain scenes in it that date it more than the typical Star Trek film gets dated. Because in a way, let's just take you know, motion picture. It's so stylized, so kind of it's so kind of out there to begin with. You're not looking at it thinking, yeah, this was certainly made in, you know, in X or Y year. Whereas here, I think you do get a very much an 80s vibe behind the film. There are a couple too many chase scenes for my liking, but I can handle, you know, a fair amount of cheese, so I can like let that rub off. The Greenpeace message has never bothered me. It really doesn't. I don't think it's particularly preachy. And as far as preachy goes, it's like, hey, you know, don't kill whales. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that message. You probably shouldn't kill whales. So yeah, I kind of like it overall. I think it is the biggest swerve of all time in a movie series, as far as I can tell. It's almost as if, you know, the next Fast and the Furious that comes out is a costume drama set in the 1920s. It's really weird, but they play it good enough, and I enjoy it.
Yeah. It's kind of like the Spaceballs of the Star Trek franchise. Because everything else seems to be normal Star Trek, and this, like you said, this just swerves off.
And by the way, I mean, although I say that some people don't like this one, this film was it was the most successful of the original series films, and it was the most successful film until we had the recent reboots, yeah, with, you know, 09 Into Darkness and Star Trek Beyond. So, you know, it was successful, and I don't think it was successful because it's, you know, comedy for comedy's sake. I do think that there's I think the film is well put together and caters for, you know, for the Trekkies, and it caters for, like, you know, the more casual audience. I think that, yeah, I think it all works well. This is one of the few films that actually my kids have seen of the original series, a bunch. I think we tried to start them on Wrath of Khan, and they kind of got bored. But everyone sat through Voyage Home and enjoyed themselves.
Well, if you want to get him to bed early one day, just start Star Trek the Motion Picture. So, okay. Now, this movie, I don't remember seeing this in the theater at all, so I'm not sure, but every video I've seen, this has been dedicated to the astronauts of the Space Shuttle Challenger, which was destroyed shortly after takeoff on January 26, 1986, killing New Hampshire teacher Krista McAuliffe. I'm sure you remember that. And it took NASA 22 years before they launched the backup teacher for the Challenger mission. So I thought, you know, that's pretty nice that they're dedicating that. And I think it's pretty cool that, you know, not only NASA waited, 22 years and sent that same backup teacher, but that she actually wanted to go. So, that was pretty good as well.
Yeah, and actually, even, I mean, it's not like a US-centric thing or anything. The dedication is also on, on the my copy of the DVD as well. And as far as I remember, it was always there.
So how come the space race was between the US and the Russians? Where was England? Or, why didn't England launch anything? Why didn't they even get into the space race?
Do you want a serious answer to that? there's no way that... England could... Well, okay. So one issue is that why did you even have a space race to begin with, right? And you might argue that the space race was very much a kind of, let's all feel better kind of initiative from the government at the time to try to get one up over the, over a rival, which really didn't mean much.
Yeah.
And you plowed a lot of money into it. Of course, there were scientific discoveries and whatnot, a huge feat of engineering. But if, in a way, it was actually quite interesting that, Kennedy was able to redefine the goals here, because the Russians obviously got into, put the first satellite into orbit, put the first man in orbit, put the first woman in orbit, had the first spacewalk, and then all of a sudden it's a, hey, actually, we think the goalpost here is landing on the moon. So it's a bit cheeky. So if you view the entire space race as just a kind of like a way of being able to one up your kind of like nearest and dearest rival. In a way, England didn't need that, because we had the 1966 World Cup where we beat Germany at football, and we've really been living off that ever since for the last 50 years. And it is true. I mean, people in England will still refer to it. We've been useless ever since, and I think Germany have won like 4 times since then. But it's we won in 66. That's all we need to know.
You achieved what you needed to. You don't need the rest.
Indeed.
All right. Okay, so the movie opens up to introduce our heroes. And then, after they discuss why they're on Vulcan, which I still don't understand how they could be on Vulcan since Vulcan was destroyed, but they show a very strange space object. Now, while you were talking, I muted myself and had to blow my nose, and now my ears popped. I can't even hear myself talk. Oh, there we go. If I had to groan in this movie at any time, I'd say it's right about here. Because it looks to me like... What? Oh, it looks to me like somebody went to the Johnsonville sausage plant to taste some nifty little sausage creations and then had an epiphany. Hey, why don't we make the probe look like this kielbasa?
Is this really any different than the Doomsday Machine? I put it to you that it's not. I don't see what the issue is. It's, yes, it's, as I've been mentioning, the first thing that happens straight after the credits, it's, hey, giant probe coming to kill Earth. I mean, that's crazy. But it's so out there, right, that it's not even trying. It's just a cylinder.
Well, that's true. But the Doomsday Machine had a purpose. It actually sucked something inside of it, so it had to have a hole. But this thing just looks like a piece of sausage floating in space, and then eventually a little ball drops from the piece of sausage. I don't know. It just seemed cheesy. But you're right. Doomsday Machine does definitely look cheesy. It didn't even have any eyes on it that we could see. At least see blinking eyes as it came at you.
Also, by the way, Vija wasn't particularly... I don't know if scary or well-designed is the right kind of criticism, but it's a very weird, abstract kind of alien thing, right? Mm-hmm. That they're just throwing out there. It's not like a cool-looking spaceship. It's not like the Death Star. It's not like one of the Star Destroyers. It is just, hey, weird cloud, be scared. And here it's, hey, probe, be scared. Mm. It is a funny one. I do give it to you. But again, often we've, me in particular, have kind of claimed that things are Star Trek-y. I don't think many film series get away with the main antagonist of the entire film being a probe that you don't communicate with and just makes a wailing noise.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't make a wailing noise. It's what it sounds like in the ocean. But they didn't know what it was or what that noise was. So, okay.
True.
So Madge Sinclair, like I said, also known as Geordi's mommy, she's playing a starship captain who encounters a strange sausage probe. So as they're now floating in space, are they losing life support or just power?
Well, life support needs to be powered by something, I would have thought.
Yeah.
But at least I think, yeah, you are expecting these guys to be a threat, be under threat. So I think they're losing. Yeah, they're in danger of dying.
Which is okay because they have some air to breathe and they have a little time before it happens. And besides, it was probably, 2 hours from the time that the sausage by the time the probe passed the ship, knocked the lights out to when Kirk dropped Wells off into the ocean, if he makes it that far. We still don't know if it even works. But I don't think they have to worry.
I think so.
Okay, so on Earth, evidence is being shown on how Admiral Kirk committed acts of war against the Klingon people. Of course.
Okay, is it nitpick time?
Yeah, because they don't care what the Klingons did to him, killing his son. And, you know, they just want his ass bad. But what's your nitpick?
Oh, the nitpick is, and this happens a couple of times throughout Star Trek, but this is kind of the most glaring, which is when the Klingon ambassador comes along and says, "Hey, I'm now going to play you a scene from Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock. Let's all sit down and enjoy it." And you think, well, okay, well, maybe they have like security cameras or something. And then what it is they show the external shot of the ship blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
Who was filming that? I mean, I can almost imagine that as we watch the show, we're almost like a godlike, good eye view of what's going on. But how the hell does the Klingon ambassador get the footage? I don't know.
The Russians.
It doesn't matter.
Maybe the Russians hacked into them and did that.
Could be.
Mm-hmm. And now, just as the ambassador says, we have the right to defend ourselves, because nobody understood what Genesis really was. You know, it was all secret, so they had nothing to go off of. Which I guess if they wanted to launch a Genesis torpedo against Kronos, might have worked, wouldn't it? What do you think it would have done to their planet?
Oh, I mean, I think expectations would be that it would be wiped out. At least, it depends how much power it has and whether it can keep going all the way around, but I would imagine so.
Here's another question I don't remember asking you in The Search for Spock. And maybe I did, I don't know. But let's say the Genesis torpedo. You can't just go to a planet, even if it works exactly like it says it does. You can't just go to a planet that doesn't have a sun nearby and just deposit this device and make an Earth-like planet that they can live on, because what's going to heat the planet? What's going to, our moon is what makes our ocean waves. With the absence of both of them, how could any planet possibly survive, even if they made it exactly like us?
Well, I think you certainly would need a sun in order to, send heat into any planet. Otherwise, you're just, any rock that's out there in the middle of nowhere is sitting at, absolute zero. So, hugely freezing, and putting together the matter for life, or even water and stuff like that, and rearranging molecules isn't going to get you very far if you don't actually have the continual heat from the sun. So you do need the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any possibility that Genesis was done around the sun? Not Genesis, but the moon. Was the moon not around the sun? Was there no heat coming in?
Don't know. The Genesis planet? I mean, obviously they had sunlight, they had light, but it's hard to say. They don't really show the sun nearby like we have on Earth.
True.
So is there, and then here's another question, is there more than one sun in our galaxy? Or is this sun the only sun that's available?
No, there are plenty of suns.
Okay. That's an interesting question. Because then it could possibly support life. And they did say recently that they found another Earth-like planet.
Yep.
Fascinating. Yep.
Indeed. So, I mean, a lot of the... actually, it's a bit strange at the moment in terms of like astronomy and, you know, the actual discovery of planets. Because I think maybe for the last 10 years or so, they've been able to make decent progress finding like larger planets, like the big gas giants, mainly because they don't see the actual planet itself, but what they see is they see a kind of like a wobble in the star or something like that. Mm. So, you know, we've known that the stars are there, and now we're getting evidence that there are planets circling them. And I think one of the biggest drawbacks, though, is that in almost all cases, these are going to be tens of light years away. So zero chance of ever sending a probe out to see them or even getting any decent information from them.
Really?
We are really getting a very, very faint sign, and we're not really going to be able to know much more about it for hundreds of years.
Hmm.
Whereas, I mean, maybe the same was true about the planets when they first noticed them as wandering stars. They didn't have the ability to actually go and look at them until many hundred years later.
Hmm.
But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, because they said it was a mere 50 or 65 light years away from us.
Yeah, so that's like 500 years travel time, best case scenario, on anything that is realistic in the foreseeable future.
Well, then we need to start working on warp drive now.
Warp drive would help a lot.
Yes, it would. Okay, so as a Klingon ambassador is whining and complaining, Sarek comes out of the shadows to defend Kirk, but actually, really, none of this matters because Admiral Kirk has been charged with 9 violations of Starfleet regulations.
I love the Klingon's absolute disgust of regulations? Starfleet regulations? I can see exactly where he's coming from. And actually, I think this Klingon's pretty good. I think he's not in it a huge amount, but he keeps the throughout all of the Star Trek films, there's always some Klingons in them. So in the original, to begin with, we see the Klingons in motion picture. We also have the Klingons in the Kobayashi Maru in Wrath of Khan, obviously in Search for Spock, and this is the Klingon for the. For the voyage home, and we always get Klingons one way or another, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. No, you have to have Klingons. Okay, so that particular Klingon ambassador was on Star Trek Voyager and Star Trek Enterprise. Fascinating. Okay. So, do you think we could guess at what his 9 charges were? I mean, we know that there was, like, in the end, they discuss some disobeying a direct order, theft of the Enterprise, sabotage of the Excelsior, destruction of the Enterprise. I mean, but there were a few missing. Do you think maybe they charged him? Well, they didn't charge him with violating a temporal prime directive.
No, not yet. Not yet. I would have thought it was when they were reading out. They mentioned that he was charged with stealing it, and then he was charged with destroying it. And I kind of thought that one of those superseded the other. It's like, well, you know, really, if you are gonna be charged with blowing up the Enterprise, there's not really any point being charged with stealing the Enterprise because surely one's much worse than the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, anyway, the crew have been on Vulcan for the last 3 months after stealing the Enterprise in the last movie and rescuing Captain Spock. And it's interesting because Spock is back to his old self. Well, sort of. I mean, he's alive and seemed just as intelligent as before. But he just doesn't understand how he feels. And, Doc, how do you feel? How do you feel?
I feel fine.
Good.
Actually, I always remember liking this scene. I always thought it was fun, and you know, obviously, a kind of person like me associates a lot with Spock, and I enjoyed this. But I do remember only a couple of years ago when I sat down and watched it with the kids, who would have been, you know, maybe oldest 10 at the time, and they loved this as well. They thought it was really cool that he had all these silly questions being answered, and he was, you know, taken on three computers at once. And then it's, how do you feel? And it's like, they got him. He doesn't understand.
Yeah. What's the matter, Spock? This thing's nuts. It's crazy. It asked me how I'm feeling. It's irrelevant. But, I mean, obviously, in 3 months, they've pretty much trained him pretty damn good. So, the Katra that went from Dr. McCoy back to Spock, I mean, was it a complete download of everything that makes him the person? Because 3 months, you would think that Spock was a completely unwritten hard drive. And within 3 months, they either downloaded the Katra back to Spock, and he knew he doesn't know everything, but he has the ability to talk, and, you know, I mean, it seems kind of quick.
Well, so that's it. I think if you were to ask what's most realistic, the most realistic thing is that this, you know, this Spock is going to be a shell of his previous self and probably have to spend his life in, you know, psychiatric care. But from the perspective of the movie, what they really want is they want Spock back in his entirety, completely in his entirety. So, yeah, you kind of have to take it that everything about Spock was transferred across, including, in fact, you know, when they mentioned about, you know, what are your opinions on death? And, you know, he seems to speak as if he knows about it and, you know, remembers experience in it. So it must be a full kind of like a brain dump from McCoy.
Has to be. Okay, so Spock must go to Earth to offer testimony. And I was just thinking, maybe I could figure out what Spock said when he offered his testimony. It says, I, Spock, swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me, V'ger. Okay, tell us what you remember. Well, I seem to remember being young. My face was contorting. I grew up fast. I didn't understand language. There were a lot of people around. And then I passed out and woke up on Vulcan. That's pretty much it.
I think I'll say, thank you, Spock, for your testimony. Yeah. You can now go.
You're excused. I don't know what he could have contributed to them, but obviously he had to be on that ship, you know, so he could say one damn minute, Admiral. Or, you know, double dumb.
He doesn't say that. Doesn't say that yet.
No, but still, he had to be on the ship to do that. So
I think he's merely there for moral support, right?
Possibly. I don't know. I mean, he went back. Obviously, they had no idea what the sausage probe was doing. He just went back to Earth and, to help his friends, I guess. I mean, they risked their careers and their lives to help him, so now he has to do the same for them. But anyway, let's see. Oh, yeah. The probe now has a hole on the bottom of it where a sausage or a soccer ball spins around back and forth, or as you say, football, spins around back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's a sophisticated probe, and it's just trying to speak to somebody. I mean, it's too bad the Universal Translator wasn't picking that up. You know, where are you, Will? Well, I've been looking for you. Show me where you are.
Now, by the way, do you think that this is the probe is like a spaceship full of whales? So isn't there like they have with the Zindi, Like, he's sitting there going, well, you know, hello, Will. Maybe this is actually, maybe it's a Zindi weapon being sent across. you know, after what happened in Enterprise.
Well, if they had wells, why wouldn't they just pop a few down and be on its way?
Oh, you mean like if you think that this thing is making sure that the whales are doing okay, and if not, you know, repopulate the whale.
Yes. Or send a few whale replacements. Or since, you know, they last populated Earth with whales, we now have new sophisticated whales that we're going to go ahead and put down here. But we're not putting whales on this planet. They're going to keep killing them. That might be it. Okay. Now, as I told you before we recorded, I couldn't find this movie at all. So I had to get it from Amazon Prime. And it's really interesting because they have a little bubble window on the side that tells facts about it. And it said the sounds that the probe makes, boom, 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 remember that? Was actually the sound of a baby's heartbeat during a sonogram.
Yeah, I think I've heard that before. That sound, I mean, it didn't immediately jump out as that to me, but I do seem to remember that.
Oh. So I guess one thing we're not going to find on Memory Alpha is who was the baby. That'd be very interesting to know, is I was the baby that sound was made off of.
You
don't know.
It might have been just stock baby, for all we know.
Stock baby.
In fact, isn't that the bit? I don't know if it's exactly the same scene, but I think they use a bit of stock footage here and there in this episode, in particular in this movie. In particular, when they're like flying above the skies, it really reminds me of the stock footage they use in Quantum Leap at the beginning. And I don't know if it's the same one or not. But yeah, I assume it was just stock baby.
Mm-hmm.
Stock baby noise.
I'm starting to think maybe Admiral Cartwright might have been one of the prophets.
But hang on, he turns out to be evil, though. So.
Oh, that's right, he did. That's right. But later in life, he becomes Ben Sisko's dad and one of the best Creole food chefs in all the world. Mwah. All right, anyway. So the ship is ready to go. Time to head to Earth to be put on trial and mine boride for the rest of their lives. But at least they have goals.
Mm-hmm.
So don't you think maybe... would you have done that? I mean, you knew that you were going to be prosecuted and you'll be spending the rest of your life mining boride, whatever that is.
I doubt they're expecting to... I doubt they're expecting to really spend the rest of their life in a, you know, mining. I think they're just obviously going back to face the consequence. I think they do have a valid defense, and also if you think about it, right, the what ended up happening, even before you saved the whales and saved Earth, they did kind of, you know, they did save the day in Search for Spock as well, right? So the Klingons did attack the Grissom before they got there, and you know, the crew of the Enterprise were able to wrestle back, make sure that certain stuff didn't stay out of the Klingon hands, and the rest of it. So even if you consider Search for Spock in isolation, it's a success that they prevented Genesis falling into enemy hands, and then they also brought Spock back to life. So I think they think they've got a good case.
Mm. But I would have liked to have seen some witnesses for the prosecution. Yeah. Let's start with the security officer. Well,
oh, you mean Tiny?
Yeah,
him.
Yeah. This guy makes a funny crack. I said to him, "Don't get cute, Tiny." Next thing you know, he's flipping me on my ass.
So do you think he's had like the last 2 years or so off work through stress-related, you know, upset caused by his encounter with Sulu?
Yes.
And the same with Mr. Was it Mr. Adventure or yes. What was the guy?
Yeah, here we go.
He's been crying in his bed ever since.
Here I was in the transporter room with the one of the greatest people in Starfleet history. I was just gushing over her. All of a sudden, she pulls out this phaser, tosses me into a closet where I sat there for 14, 15 hours till somebody found me. It was terrible. There we go. That would have been their testimony. So the probe is causing widespread atmospheric disturbances on Earth, and it's time to send out a planetary distress call. I guess maybe some other planets can help them or something. Now, obviously, it was for ships. But what would have done any good? Every ship that comes near this probe is just, power is sucked out or they're just floating in space. So, I'd have to say Earth is on its own.
Well, I thought the main thing here was just basically putting like a quarantine beacon around Earth. Just to say, hey, we're screwed. Stay away. We're screwed. Stay away.
Yeah.
On a repeating loop.
Yeah. That's true. That's what it was, too, essentially. But Kirk and crew pick up that signal you mentioned and determine the probe is actually hailing calls sent to Earth. And it seems to be Spock who hones in on the idea that the signal is directed to something else other than man. I thought he got onto that a little too quickly.
He did. He absolutely did. Because, at no point in Star Trek ever is there any question that it's aimed at the humans or the human equivalents. At no point does someone turn up at the Klingon homeworld and the Enterprise doesn't go to Kronos, send out a message, and then when the Chancellor picks up, they say, look, only Klingon arrogance would have thought it's aimed at you. I'm trying to get through to your Targ. It doesn't happen.
There you go. I mean, he said the president did say it was aimed at Earth's oceans, but no, he didn't. When he said it was vaporizing the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't necessarily say the signal is directed directly at the water, not at us. The signal was just directed at Earth, and everybody was picking it up. So,
and actually, by the way, talking about the president, in my mind, what ends up happening after this particular episode, or this particular thing, I don't mean episode as in movie,
mm-hmm.
but after this event, is that, the helmsman on the Saratoga?
Mm-hmm.
By Star Trek VI, in my mind, he runs for office and he takes over as president. And I think it's all down to the fact that at this stage, he's sitting there at the helm going, this guy's bloody incompetent down there. What the hell is he doing? I'm going to run against him.
Yeah.
5 years from now, I'm going to run against him. He'll be sorry.
He'll be sorry. Okay. But they do, in fact, determine that the only thing capable of understanding the sounds are humpback whales, which have been extinct since, a few years from today, I guess. The 20th century. Did they say the 21st century or the 20th century?
No, 21st.
Okay, good. So they did allow for 100 years or so.
Yeah, yeah. I find that... So I think Kirk mentions, well, why don't we just play some humpback whale music back at them?
Hmm.
And they don't even try that. I know that Spock says, well, we'll be talking and we'll be responding in gibberish. But I'm not necessarily convinced that that's true because... So there's one leap you have to take to assume that this is a form of like message or a form of communication. And then the next leap that Spock is taking is that it's actually a very sophisticated form of, language.
No.
Whereby there's like, I'll make one noise and then I'll respond with the correct grammar. And I always felt much more comfortable living in the former than the latter, because I'm not convinced right at the end of the episode when they bring the humpback whales and it's kind of, yeah, you okay? Yeah, we're fine. You sure? Yeah, okay, we'll be on our way. I don't believe a conversation happened, but they seem to give the impression that the conversation has happened. And I don't quite buy that. I much more prefer it as like the equivalent of a mating call or the equivalent of just a general, a general message rather than a specific form of communication.
Well, that's true. I mean, even if they responded back and said, my head hurts, at least they're there. They think they're there. But then again, couldn't the probe actually scan the planet and say, I don't see any whale life form at all, but why are we hearing whale sounds? The probe that could knock out power to the world, I think, was more sophisticated enough that they could have scanned and saw there's absolutely no whale population on this planet whatsoever that we can see.
And also, I don't know what the... are we expected to believe that up until now there's been continual whale communication with these aliens or with this probe-like thing?
No.
You know, but what happened here? Why is the probe here? Why did the probe come? Does the probe just turn up at most planets going... Any whales? I mean, I don't get it.
I see. So maybe the probe is, it just goes from planet to whale planet to whale planet and, you know, checks in and sees what they need. Kind of like if we went back to a piece of the action and collected our cut.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. Because I think they say that, you know, it wants to know why it lost communication. So you're right. Obviously, whales have a sophisticated subspace radio transceiver.
You see, that's unlikely.
No, that's true. That would be unlikely. Plus, why did it take them so long to discover the whales were missing? Now, you could say, well, maybe it took them how many years between the 21st century and the 23rd century? You know, it took them 200 years to travel to Earth when they lost contact. As soon as that last whale was hunted and harpooned, the communication signal vanished. Well, they launched the probe that took 200 years to get there. That seems unlikely because it was so far away. How does a subspace signal get to the whale planet? Yeah, this is... okay. I'm starting to give myself a headache now.
I mean, by the way, I don't think any of this makes sense.
No.
I think you can very easily claim that it doesn't make sense. But I'm not even sure what they were trying to go for in terms of, you know, we know it doesn't make sense, but we're going to set out this stall. One thing, I hope that they weren't communicating, by the way, between the whales and the probe. Although... I'm kind of minded to believe that that's what they were trying to go for, because what would happen at the end of the episode if once, you know, George and Gracie were put into the whales, put into the oceans, and, you know, the probe saying, whales, are you there? They just respond, yeah, kill them all.
Yeah.
They killed us all.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not in a better position.
Yeah, imagine if the whales started hunting us now.
Yeah.
Okay. So the only way to solve this issue is to find some humpback whales. You know, that's so they can tell the probe what to go do with itself. I like that part.
And they are very casual in just stating, we need to go back into the past. Everything okay? Good.
Yeah.
And it's a similar situation in First Contact. Although in First Contact, it's slightly different in the sense that it's the Borg that go back into the past. Uh-huh. So they just have to follow them. But here it's like, okay, should we go back into the past and sort this out? Sure, let's go. And I know they did it in the original series, but it's, you know, you can't use that as an excuse. It's still a silly idea.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see here. So they figure out the only way to do it is to go back to the past and to bring two humpback whales forward in the past into the future, so they can again tell this probe what to go do with itself. Let's see here. Oh, did you? Here's another thing that kind of bothered me. When they're doing their time warp back, why are we hearing snippets of what's to come? Admiral, that be whales here. Jim, where are we? You know, all that stuff that they did while they were going back in time. Why would they put that stuff in? I mean, just the Admiral, there'd be whales here. You're supposed to believe this might not work.
Well, I don't think that you pick up on it being, predictive of the future. I think, certainly when you watch it, I don't think you're thinking, oh, they've already told us how it's going to end. I think it's vague enough, or it's where it's in a weird enough state. I mean, my major gripe with the time travel, apart from the fact that it's, couldn't be true under the laws of physics, or at least our understanding of the laws of physics currently, is that what's up with these paper mache heads? What's that about?
Say that again, I'm sorry. What?
What's up with the paper mache heads? Why did he have all these heads appearing in the clouds and
all that
kind of, I'm going to say nonsense, but what's up with that?
Yeah.
I mean, did we in the UK get a censored version and something else was going on and they have to hack something together in a weekend?
No.
I've never understood that scene.
Yeah, no, that didn't make any sense either. It looked really cheap, actually, because it was, as each person of the crew had their line that they are going to say in the future, well, I guess the past, but the future's past, their head popped out of the cloud. And yeah, you're right, that didn't make any sense. So, in the original series, Assignment Earth, when they had to go back to 1968 to, figure out how man survived past that time, remember that?
Wasn't it accidental, though?
No.
Wasn't Assignment?
No, they...
Assignment Earth wasn't accidental.
No, they did their breakaway thing to see how humans survived the late 20th or the 1968, and that's when Gary Seven accidentally beams aboard.
So, one of them is accidental, right? One of them
yes.
isn't. That's Tomorrow is Yesterday.
Yes.
Or one of those ones with Yesterday in it, where they get. Yeah, I think that's the accidental one, and they also have it in the Naked Time as well. They do the time travel.
Yeah.
As well, right at the end. For no reason whatsoever. It's like you have an entire episode and you go, okay, we'll resolve this. And then it's like, oh, but by the way, we went back in time for 4 weeks.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They have to do it again.
What the hell is that about?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think in that case, they just stay out of the way for 4 weeks. I think that what they end up doing is that, in trying to escape the collapsing planet, they get thrown back in time for 4 weeks and they just have to stay out of the way and just, play chess, watch a bit of TV, just stay calm.
All right. But anyway, yeah, so I guess I really didn't care for all the... It just kind of gives it away. There should have been a mystery as to... We don't even know if they're going to make it back in time, let alone make it forward in time. But, okay. So, here's another issue. To return to our time, we need to recrystallize ourselves. And there's only one way of doing it. Nuclear power. All they need to do is get some nuclear reactors. And you can find that in every 7-Eleven. So, should be no problem for the movie. Okay, so, we know that the movie is trying to say, hey guys, look at these whales. They are nice creatures. Let's not hunt them anymore because this could happen to us. But now,
I don't think that's how they could happen. I don't think it's. Well, I don't think they're really postulating that. I think the biggest kind of like the message of this story is when I think when Gillian Taylor starts talking to her boss just before he's. I think at some point, she mentioned that we don't know whether or not they're intelligent, and I think she makes a statement that, my compassion for someone isn't determined by my estimate of how intelligent they are.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of more of the core message rather than, don't hunt these whales because you never know when a big probe that might come and grab you.
Yeah. Never know. But still, I get two messages out of this movie. One is, we need to treat the whales better than we do. And, oh, by the way, nuclear power is too dangerous and it's going to destroy us someday.
Did they really do that? I didn't catch that. I know that whenever Star Trek goes back to the past, and in particular with Little Green Men, right, they do the, what? Atom bombs? These guys are stupid. We can sell them anything.
Yeah.
But I always thought it was more of a kind of like a throwaway line rather than an actual kind of like, you know, political polemic that they're trying to, you know, get out there.
Hmm. Perhaps. Maybe they just, yeah. Well, because, you know, they got rid of nuclear weapons and nuclear power by the time the 23rd century comes along. But here, it's everywhere.
Well, hang on. I mean, you say nuclear power, but, you know, realistically, just the matter-antimatter reactor, it's very, very similar to what the concept of nuclear power would be. It's a very, very similar thing. Now, you might argue that, like, you know, fission reactors have a lot of waste surrounding them, so then you start moving towards like nuclear fusion, and, you know, theoretically a lot cleaner nuclear reactor. But I really consider the matter-antimatter warp reactor as being almost the pinnacle of the nuclear industry.
Yeah.
So I often see this in the same way that, right, that when McCoy was talking about the medicine being, you know, old, and, you know, what, you don't want to cut his head open and stuff like that. I always thought of it more as a discussion about how crude it is, rather than it being like evil per se.
Hmm. Yeah. My God, man, drilling holes in his head. Yeah. So yeah, it makes sense, because if you think about it, the matter antimatter could be just as dangerous as nuclear power. Hmm. Okay. So once they land, now it seems like everything in this movie is serious up to this moment, because once they land in Golden Gate Park, this is where all the fun begins. You know, and as I said in when I was describing the stars and guest stars, you know, did you see that? No, neither did you. So shut up. And then we got the crew walking the streets of San Francisco. Well, double dumbass on you. So I think this is kind of where it all begins to have fun. And this is where I think it's a lot better. I mean, we have Captain Kirk and his reading glasses. You know, wasn't that a gift from Dr. McCoy? Yeah, and it will be again.
We'll be again. That's great. I like that a lot.
But will it? It will be again, because they're going to go back to the future, and those glasses are sitting in the past. So it's,
yeah, but the glasses will eventually travel through, because they were always, because McCoy bought them as an antique, right?
Yeah.
So I think the whole point is that he's kind of like fulfilling a kind of like a predestination paradox kind of scenario, whereby he gets given the glasses that are an antique, and then he goes and puts them back into the past as well, and then potentially those ones that he put back in the past eventually get picked up by McCoy again in the future after having existed for an extra 400 years or whatnot.
Okay, here's the chicken and the egg, though. So McCoy gives him the glasses that Kirk will eventually drop off on Earth, but the lenses are not intact.
Mm-hmm.
When McCoy gives them to him, the lenses are intact. Yep, so they fix them?
But they're going to have to fix the lenses at least.
Oh, fascinating. I really didn't even think about that. I just figured, no, they're not going to be, you know, it's not going to be a gift again, because he's dropped them off on Earth. But this is fascinating. It's kind of like the transparent aluminum. Did that guy actually invent the stuff?
Yeah. So I really like the scene. And maybe we can talk about the scene more in general. But I like Scotty's attitude of... Actually, I like both Scotty and McCoy. I think it's good that these two guys were put together. And one thing I enjoy about the film is that it splits everyone up with tasks while they're on Earth. And I think everyone does well. Everyone has their moment to shine. Uhura and Chekhov have their moment. Sulu has his moment. And the bit where Scotty has great scene, in particular with the transparent aluminum. Now, at the point where Bones pulls him aside and says, "You're not really thinking about changing the timeline, are you?" And he goes, "Well, who's to say he didn't invent the thing?" And then McCoy's face goes from, "I'm really concerned," to, Yeah, that's a good argument. And I just love that because McCoy is so convinced by such an unconvincing argument that, you know, that Scotty just puts out there. I just love it. It's not for a second do they really care that they're changing the timeline. And I think they're fully aware that they are indeed changing the timeline.
Well, do you think Scotty would know who created transparent aluminum? I mean, he knows.
Probably.
Yeah, he should know it was Nichols because he's actually putting in the entire formula for transparent aluminum. He has to know everything about it.
Or at very least, right, you know, the decade and where it was discovered.
Right.
Right. If it's, you know, you would have a guess as to whether it was, you know, 1980s or, you know, 2260. You know, there's a big difference between that. It's a difference between, oh, we think it was done in the late 20th century versus the Andorians gave us the formula 400 years later. So he should know vaguely, right?
Right.
And if it was vaguely invented around this time, then I suppose it might not be that harmful, you know, that, you know, dude A versus dude B gets it.
All right. Okay. All right. So, Kirk reads the side of a what? Oh, jeez. Maybe I should put this on mute, huh? What do you think? Kirk reads the side of the bus to find George and Gracie. That's pretty cool. George and Gracie Burns. You know who George and Gracie were, right?
We've had this discussion before.
Okay.
And I've said no, and I will say no again.
Oh, okay. I'm sure it's George Burns and Gracie Alley. I'm sure.
TV? Movie?
Yes.
People?
Yes.
Movies?
Yes, both.
Okay.
I think they're, long dead, but anyway. Two whales, George and Gracie are two whales who are going to be evicted from their home and will need a new place to live. So, what is this Cetacean Institute going to do now that whales are gone? I mean, why wouldn't they keep their whales? It's the whole purpose of having the Institute, isn't it?
Well, I mean, they mentioned that it does cost a lot to keep the whales, and I suspect that they've just not got the funds. I mean, if it's kind of a pseudo museum stroke, you know, research area, then I can see that they might have previously expanded to keep whales and then thought, actually, you know, it's getting too much. Although, to be honest with you, isn't the case that, I don't know if whales in particular, but I think that killer whales and dolphins and stuff, if you've been in captivity for any length of time and they mention they came in as youngsters, don't they basically have zero chance of survival once they get out into the big wide world or into the ocean? I didn't think that they would be. I thought there's always an issue that you really can't send them back without them being, you know, completely ill-equipped to live a quote unquote natural life.
But who's going to hurt them? Other whales? Other?
Well, they need to find, you know, they need to find like a group of whales for breeding and stuff like that. They also need to find food, which they've not needed to do up until that point. And they need to, you know, they're going to have to swim thousands of times further than they've swam in their little swimming pool as well. You know, they're going to be migrating across the world, you know, numerous times throughout their life. So all of these factors they've not been accustomed to.
Ah, okay. Okay. Yeah, that's true. The punk on the bus. That's always described, punk on the bus. They created that song for this, didn't they?
Yes, so it's the...
I Hate You.
I Hate You. My understanding is that the guy that played this dude ended up working for Star Trek later on.
Really?
So I don't know why. I probably should have researched it. I'm under the impression that he became a set designer or on the on the arty side of development. And he worked for Trek.
Hmm.
I hope I haven't just made that up.
I'm not sure. Because I'm actually, Kirk Thatcher is his name, and I'm actually looking at his IMDb page. I'm not seeing anything in Star Trek as far as writing, directing. I mean, obviously, let's see, producer, no. Star Trek The Voyage Home, associate producer. So he was that. Art department, nothing. Actor.
Okay, I'm being proven wrong. It's all good.
That's all right. No problem. He does have soundtrack credits. He wrote the I Hate You song.
Yes, I heard that.
So that's pretty cool. Maybe, yeah. Okay. The punk on the bus. Maybe one of the funniest moments was when Spock pinches him and, you know, whammo, he's out. Either that or, no, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
Actually, there's a lot of quotable dialogue in this film. I think more so than like the other Star Trek films up to this point. And one that I always use, and I always have an internal chuckle, is everyone remember where we parked? And it's not even really a line, but the way that he delivers it makes me smile. And I do the same thing whenever we walk away from the car.
Yeah. Except for I do have trouble remembering where I park. But anyway, yeah, that was pretty good. But I'm surprised people don't run into the ship a lot. I mean, people use the park and, you know, just walk along and bam, ouch.
Indeed. And in particular, also, isn't there a giant footprint as well?
Yes, where'd that come from?
So, yeah, it should have been quite, you know, quite obvious that something was going on.
Okay. You know, I said that the guy on the bus might be one of the funnier moments, but actually, no, I think Chekhov and Uhura are looking for the nuclear vessels. I think that's gut-busting. I mean, it was so funny. Excuse me, can you tell me, point me to the nuclear vessels? You know, like asking where the, you know, convenience store is. Or where's 3rd Street?
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's good. I like that a lot. And also, in a way, those two are going to get into more trouble than the others, right? They're obviously with Chekhov with his Russian accent, mm-hmm. and you know, you're also unlikely to be a youngish female looking for, you know, nuclear vessels. Why have those two been sent for this? It's a bit of a mismatch.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, and they stumble across this lady and they want to know where how to get to Alameda nuclear vessels. And she says, oh, I don't know that one. I think it's across the bay. And Alameda. No kidding. That's what we just said. And from what I remember, I thought she wasn't supposed to talk. And didn't they have to, like, chase her down and make her sign the release or become a member of the Screen Actors Guild or something so that they could actually keep that in, because it was pretty funny.
I haven't heard that.
Oh. Okay. Or the cop on the motorcycle, you know, is just staring at him. Nuclear vessels.
He didn't talk, though.
No, he didn't. No, that's what I'm saying. He's just staring at him as nuclear vessels. I mean, that's pretty damn funny. So what else? Oh, and then it also said on my Amazon Prime when Sulu and who was with Sulu? Well, as they were looking for, you know, a way to find something, and they come across this argument between the Asian restaurant worker and the owner as they chased him out the door.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right at the beginning, or very close, at least.
Yeah, and maybe something to the extent, if I remember reading correctly, that may have been one of Sulu's ancient ancestors. He was born in San Francisco.
Yeah, he doesn't. He mentions that. So maybe. I mean, it's possible that they meant that. It's possible that someone also just invented it because he looked a little Asian.
Yeah, right.
So yeah. I don't want to fall into that camp.
Right. And the only reason that it was even significant is right on the side of the building was, can't find it here. You know, look in the phone book. I think it was.
Yes, yep.
So Dr. Jillian Taylor gives a tour about how sweet and wonderful the whale really is. As Spock is taking a dip with them, that was pretty good as well. And everybody's staring at the window as he's swimming with the fishies. You can see Kirk's face. He's about freaking out. And he stands right next to the nun. Taylor's standing right next to the nun, and she says, "What the hell?" So, I mean, a little things you pick up on.
But it's also at the big one. She's talking about, we don't quite know what whale song is for, and we don't know if it's a form of communication or part of the mate and rescue. And then the old woman goes, "Perhaps he's singing to that man there."
Yeah.
I mean, as if that's the answer that science has been waiting for. It's good that the professor's turned up finally. And then, she kind of goes, "What the hell?"
Yeah. Messing my tank and messing with my wells. Well, he wasn't a well rapist. I mean, come on. But anyway. So the doctor's heading home after a long, trying day of trying to make the whales feel better after being molested by Spock.
Mm-hmm.
And she comes across these two walking back to San Francisco and picks them up. And this is where we actually find out that Spock may have done a little too much LDS.
Yeah. Indeed.
Indeed. Oh, and Gracie's pregnant. Go on.
I mean, this is the bit as well where kind of Spock's trying to kind of blend in, like, they're not the hell your whales and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Very good.
Right. Here's another question, though. These people, they love the whales. They're going to, they want to preserve the whales because they're going to be extinct someday. So they're going to send a pregnant Gracie out to the sea to fend for herself.
Mm-hmm.
That don't make any sense. I mean, she knows Gracie's pregnant, but they haven't released that to the public yet. Like, whoop, big whoop. How do you know that? It doesn't matter how I know. But, I mean, why would they... I mean, it doesn't seem right. They'd send Gracie out to fend for herself when she's pregnant.
Well, I mean, I always got the impression that it wasn't a... You know, it's obviously not these guys' decisions, right? It's, the bureaucracy above... That are making the decisions, and no doubt they've made representations to keep the whales safe. I think that maybe also the fact that she's pregnant probably means that there is a ticking clock, right? That there is a question about, well, what do you do with the newborns? Can you feasibly have four whales or maybe more whales living in the same area? It might have been a crunch point where you either have to let them go now or you have to expand the area that they have. I would assume, by the way, that the kids need their mothers in order and the rest of the group to survive. So I doubt the option of just taking the babies after they've been born and shoving them into the ocean was an option.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway. So Kirk offers to take the whales and proposes to go to dinner, and let's talk about it over some dinner. And they go to a pizza joint. Pizza comes to the table, but nope, they gotta go. Not even get to have one slice.
Sorry, let me just add, when you mentioned about the pizza, there's a bit where she asks, "Oh, do you like Italian?" So I love Italian. And then Spock's going, "No.
Yes. No. Yes.
No.
Yes. 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 No. No. Yes."
No. And then also the way Spock is that he said, "Oh, you're at Berkeley? I was not."
Yeah.
Just great delivery.
Oh, yeah. And
I can only imagine what this woman's thinking these guys are up to. In fact, if there's one criticism of her, she kind of hangs around Kirk a bit too long when clearly something's amiss. Clearly something's gone wrong.
And then how does she pick apart that he's from outer space?
Well, I think she didn't really mean to say that, right? She just was like coming up with the most outrageous suggestion possible.
Oh. I mean, because he has his communicator. And I guess at that time, you know, we didn't have the cell phone technology we do today. But still, mm-hmm. we did have walkie-talkies.
Yeah, you actually, that's one thing I think, maybe I'm going to give Shatner far too much credit here. But the thing in the scene where he gets kind of where they notice that he had this communicator, I always took away from this, in particular when he tries to brush it off, is that he thinks he's been rumbled. And then he doesn't realize that actually, you know, pagers and mobile phones, although they're very early still, they are available to some people. Which is then why the question of, oh, are you a doctor, comes up. Because it's only, you know, it's only a certain number of people that would ever have the ability to be contacted in an emergency.
Right.
So I quite like that. But maybe I'm seeing far too much subtlety here in the actual performance.
Okay, so we discussed about the transparent aluminum and how the doctor may have actually developed the stuff. You know, how do we know he didn't invent the stuff? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
But this entire scene is wonderful, even down to kind of Scotty getting so upset, and he's come millions of miles, thousands, thousands of miles to see them, and then he gets and sits down on the computer, and he's doing the computer, and it's like, and he hands him the mouse, and he picks up the mouse and pretends to talk into it,
yeah.
And just use the keyboard. He's like, oh, keyboard.
So, exactly. He didn't have any idea what this technology was. It's obviously way too obsolete, but yet he's a skilled master on that keyboard. Now, I did see a piece of trivia again that says transparent aluminum was actually developed in 2009, and it's called aluminum oxynitride.
Okay, but this is... Okay, yeah, but no. In the sense that this is clearly not what they were going for in the film, right? So in the film, they specifically mention like a compound and a feature of the compound. So it can withstand a certain amount of pressure and be certain, you know, a certain thickness. And I don't think that's what they invented. I think what they invented was, you know, they put aluminium with some other stuff and it was more or less transparentish. And I think... I don't really know the full story, but to me it just smells very much that they've just they know that transparent aluminum's a thing, so they've just said, yeah, we've invented it, sure.
So you don't think it's really real?
No. But also, every now and again, you'll see scientists claim that they've invented like the cloak from Harry Potter, or you know they've managed to like, you know, quote unquote beam, you know, subatomic particles or whatnot, and it's a friendly label you often put on a scientific discovery, which frankly is not. I personally don't think it does the science any justice, and I think it's often there just as a way of getting more media attention. Oh. And when I say media, I mean like mainstream media rather than scientific community media.
Oh, I see. Okay. Because I read about the transparent or the little speck of matter being beamed too. So I don't know if it's real or not.
No, but I think the issue there was about quantum entanglement, as far as I remember. There might have been other ones, but quantum entanglement is different from beaming. It's about being able to, you know, being able to have an effect on other things around the universe. By having kind of like a separate, well, by having some matter that's connected to some other matter. I think that that's what they were always talking about with beaming. But again, it sounds a lot nicer, right? When you can say, hey, beaming. It's, everyone knows what beaming is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so. Chekhov and Uhura get to the nuclear reactors aboard the Enterprise, oddly enough. And they begin draining nuclear water or something, which is obviously detected. And they try to beam up, but they can only beam out one at a time. And Uhura goes first, leaving the Russian behind. And Chekhov, who's actually injured, trying to escape. Now, I wonder, I was going to ask Brian Detamore this because he was a Navy man. But I wonder, do you think it's true that if the Navy police are chasing somebody, all the personnel hit the deck?
I would have thought they would have had a much better chance of catching him had they not. You know, had just one or two of them stepped in and blocked him.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have got out.
Right. Yes, I agree with that. Okay. So Chekov is interrogated and actually has his Starfleet identification card. That to me also made no sense. Yeah. Pavel Chekov, Commander, United Federation of Planets. I mean, the guy's reading this stuff. And obviously he probably thinks it's crap because he's not thinking time traveler.
There's a part of me that, again, I think this scene is funny and it's nice and comedically played, but I have no idea where does Chekov think he's going with this in a way. You know, why is he saying, you know, I'm in Starfleet? I mean, really? No one was given a cover story before they head out into the, you know, into the big wide world 300 years in the past. It doesn't make sense.
You would think that they'd keep their mouths shut. Not say a word about it. Okay. So Dr. Taylor stops by the Institute probably to feed the whales and give them their medicine because they had some kind of infection after that guy jumped in the pool, you know. I don't know what he did. Here's another question. Let's go back a little bit. As Spock is having a mind meld with these things, how can that work with whales? Unless he has his own universal translator, or maybe he sees images. How does Spock interpret whale thought as to not only how these whales know that man is hunting them, because they've been in captivity all their lives, they're angry about what man has done to them. How could he get all this?
True. I have no idea. Right. I have no idea. I mean, there are also, you know, there are women that go through pregnancy without knowing they're pregnant, and how a whale is expected to be able to rationalize it is also perhaps debatable. Gracie and George and Gracie, they're very sad. They like you very much. They're very sad about the plight of the common working whale. It was a bit of a stretch.
Right. Plus, he was able to tell them that they want to take them into the future to repopulate their species, and they go, that's just fine.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure that, you know, so there are a lot of things here. I'm not entirely sure that a whale has a concept of what pregnancy is. I'm not entirely sure that a whale has a concept of what, you know, humans are or what being hunted. And I'm certain they don't have a concept of going into the future in my spaceship is. So I can't imagine that conversation really happened in the way that they kind of attempt to show it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So then I was also wondering, they get them in the future. They've got two whales, okay, George and Gracie, male and female. Do whales give birth to more than one whale, or is it one whale at a time? And
I am not an expert, but I think it's probably one at a time.
Okay.
For the larger mammals.
So then, only my mind would go here. So then, after they've given birth, after she's given birth to the whale, one of them then has to mate with that whale, who then has to mate with the new whale, and to where they can rebuild their population.
No, sure. I think it's at best described as a very short-term solution. If you're not going back to get plenty of whales, it's a very short-term solution. And to be honest, look, let's just say that they did have like three whales babies instead of one. Does that make it any better? Not really, right?
No, because, you know, Danny still has to you know, take those girls someday.
Oh, dear.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Now, does anything funky happen when, you know, they have to mate with each other? Do they have a whale with only one fin or, you know, an extra eye in the center of their head? Huh. Okay, anyway. But she comes to the Institute maybe to feed them and discovers that they're gone. They were released early. And she slaps that guy. You son of a... Anyway. Then she decides...
I like that bit. I think she's well within her rights to punch her.
That's right.
And if you think about it, again, you know, always projected onto the real world here. This is someone like, you know, slapping her boss.
Yeah.
Like, slap. She doesn't hold back.
No. No. And besides, you know, if it turns out that maybe Kirk is telling the truth and they're going to go forward in time, maybe she's going to go with them. So she basically just, you know, slapped herself out of a job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So she drives to Golden Gate Park. Pretty interesting special effects for the time as well, as she smacks herself onto that ship. But, okay, let's do some honesty here. Was I the only one who kind of liked the scene where Dr. Taylor was running in the windy, windy park, only to find out, boy, she's a perky girl, ain't she?
I have no idea what you mean.
I think
the answer to the question is yes, you were the only one.
You're the only one. She was not wearing a bra during that scene.
And was she not?
No, she couldn't have been. She was way too perky. Maybe not. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't have, like, the full widescreen experience. Perhaps I missed something here.
Okay. So Uhura finds out that Chekhov was rushed to emergency surgery because as they were chasing him, he somehow falls down about 40 feet or whatever it was. And he's not expected to survive. So Kirk, McCoy, and Dr. Taylor pose as doctors and go searching the hospital for him. And there were some pretty interesting moments. You know, what's wrong with you?
Kidney dialysis.
Dialysis? Crap. What is wrong with these people? He hands her a pill. And she just pops it in her mouth. Here, take this.
We have to trust doctors, right?
Yeah, I guess we do. Yeah. That is amazing. I would love to find out what that pill was and how it worked, because she grows a new kidney. All right.
Now, people do complain about that in the sense that, are we expected to believe that, you know, that McCoy just kind of keeps a whole load of these pills hanging around in his pocket? But I kind of enjoy McCoy here. What I take away from this is that isn't it great that McCoy can McCoy is in his grumpy form. He's kind of wandering around the place and he's, you know, he's sorting stuff out, and I kind of enjoy it.
Yeah,
that's the whole point of, you know, the fact that McCoy is out and about.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if it's a pill that just kind of cure all. No matter what it is, if something is wrong in your body, it fixes it. Instead of specifically, he's not going to have kidney dialysis pills that regrow kidneys or lungs or something. I mean, I wonder if it just, it cures everything that's wrong.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, he's obviously a doctor, so he would know what the, you know, what the underlying cause would be, or most likely be. And if that's the case, then it's not so much, you know, fixing the one specific thing, it's fixing the more general problem.
Right.
Most likely.
Yep, that's what I was wondering. But the hospital stuff was pretty darn hilarious as well. You know, the chase through the corridors is a fix. I forgot to mention, they do fix Chekhov by this little thing they pop on his head.
After he has a kind of like a pretty good, you know, argument with the doctor, right?
Yeah.
You know, grumpy McCoy is in good form. It's kind of these, actually, the two scenes, the scene in the hospital and the scene in the aircraft carrier as Chekhov is running away are the kind of the chase scenes that I think date the movie somewhat. I don't particularly mind them, but I can see how certain people might, you know, criticize them.
Oh yeah.
Well, because it is a little bit silly, right? It's a little bit silly. It's all done in jest. It's all very clear that it's not to be taken really seriously, right? It's, you wouldn't have a scene like this in a modern day Trek film.
No, I suppose not. No. But, you know, they're pretty good. Dr. Taylor has immediate postprandial upper abdominal distension.
Yeah, actually, Michael, I think DeForest Kelly only just managed to get that one out. I think he stumbles a little bit at the beginning. But again, you know exactly where they're going with that. The fact that Kirk stops, you know, turns to McCoy, asks him, what was that? You know, he's clearly setting McCoy up to deliver the punchline.
Yeah, cramps. She has cramps. Ah, a bit. And then, of course, there's one little mistake. Chasing through the hospital, the woman grows a new kidney. Fully functional? Fully functional. Kind of like Data, maybe. Aha! Get it? Fully functional?
Mm-hmm.
And they beam out of the hospital while still in the elevator, which I don't think could happen because you have a cell phone, right?
Yes.
Does it work in elevators?
It can. It depends on the lift. Some lifts it work. Some, but are you going to say that because your phone doesn't work in the lift, somehow the transporter wouldn't work?
Yes.
Stretching.
I don't know, man. Yeah. But, you know, the cops run down. It had to be one floor. Get down there, they get their guns out, and nothing's in there. Where the hell they go? But anyway, it's time to leave. Thank you, Doctor, for all your help, and we'll be seeing you. Maybe I'll try and get back here again for you, girly. But she jumps Kirk and beams aboard. I hope that she isn't supposed to do something important in the future because she is gone. I'm sure her family realized. Has anybody seen Julian in the last, say, month or two? I don't know. Nobody's been able to find her. She's gone.
Now don't get me wrong, but she kind of comes across as a cat lady. So I'm just surprised that I would be worried that there's like 6 or 7 cats at home that eventually over the next like week and a half starve to death.
Oh, there we go. There we go. Okay. Yeah, because she just disappeared from time, actually. They never found her body or anything. Oh, maybe they did an investigation and her manager might have been charged with murder because he was last yes. seen with her. He's got her DNA on his face. So maybe he was charged with it.
So you think once she gets back to the Enterprise, logs into the computers, looks up her past and realizes that her manager did a 25-year stretch for her murder.
Yeah. And she then says, wow, the son of a bitch got put in jail for that.
Got all he deserved.
Yeah. Oops, sorry. Anyway. So the ship was able to find the whales, but now they have to try and beat a whaling ship. I'm not sure what language they were speaking as they were talking. You have any idea?
No, I don't. I mean, they said they was off Alaska, so they didn't look Japanese. And if they're not going to be Japanese, I assume they'd be Russians.
Yeah.
But it didn't sound Russian.
No.
So.
Anyway, but. I did like the idea of the bird of prey decloaking right in front of them. I mean, it's priceless.
This is a strange Trek episode in the sense that we do not get the Enterprise in this entire show until right at the end. And again, I think that is good that they chose to do that.
Right.
But they did. They also did really have the ship. They have like the Klingon ship, which is a bit of, you know, beaten up and, but the way that the ship decloaks and is directly on top of them is just it's just super, and it's perfect. And you see them basically going, yeah, we probably shouldn't be here. And they try to spin around as fast as they can, and obviously they're just sitting there tail spinning. I really like the imagery of the bird of prey decloaking over the whaling ship.
Oh yeah, even when the guy is trying to spin that wheel around and he's staring at it the ship is moving and he's got to turn his head and contort his head to like, what the hell is that, you know, type of thing. So yeah, that is pretty cool. And then of course we have the Admiral, that be Wells here. Yeah, we know that because you already said that once. But now it's time to go home. And Spock tries to calculate the rate of acceleration to the something curve because something is no longer a constant. I'm not sure what it was. But now we have to, you know, we have the wells, we have the water in the tank, and we have all this stuff that we have to now try and figure out the best way to do it. Let me ask you a question.
Go on.
This whole movie, did it seem like they were on a time crunch? I mean, besides the fact that the wells were going to be released in a couple days and then they had to go to the sea and find two wells, which they could have done. All the recrystallization. Let's say they took a year to do this. Would it have been a big deal? Because I felt there was too much of a time crunch.
Well, I think that the time crunch only comes from the fact that I think George and Gracie are, they present themselves very early and they think, yeah, this is perfect. Why don't we go after these two? But I kind of felt that there wasn't as much as a time kind of crunch as you often get in these time travel episodes. And in particular, if you have any form of time travel at your disposal, you're not in a hurry, or you need not be in a hurry. And that's one thing that I sometimes get a little bit confused about. That, look, if you can go back to last Tuesday, then go back to last Tuesday and then try. And if you don't succeed, no biggies, go back to last Tuesday again.
Yeah.
It's not that much of an issue.
Or, yeah, or go back another week before, you know, the whales got released and just, you know, beam them out of the tank one day. Hey, has anybody seen the whales? Well, we were going to get rid of them, but we didn't have a chance. I have no idea where they went. They must have escaped or something. So, but anyway. So after a very bumpy ride, they do in fact reach their time, back to their time, at the precise moment that they left. And you could tell by the way the glass breaks at Starfleet headquarters or whatever that is, their outpost or something. And then all of a sudden, Sarek sees the ship. Now, here's another question I just now thought of, so let me formulate this.
Go on.
Sarek is staring out the window at the time that all that glass blows in. Do you think he was smart enough to know that if they were going to go back in time, they're going to be right here, right now, if they succeed? And that's what he was looking at.
Well, I don't think so, because they don't. They basically after they go through this time travel thingy, they don't end up. They don't have control over where they land.
Right.
As far as I know, I mean, I know that Spock does a couple of calculations, like, oh, where do we want to land on the planet? But you know, realistically, I'll do the calculation to make sure you get, you know, to the right time around the Earth somewhere, and then I'll do a different calculation to land on the Earth. Once you have the much more information. So I always felt that the Enterprise was really crash landing, and I was kind of surprised that they managed to crash land over 300 years and basically land in exactly the right spot that they needed to.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's a good thing the Golden Gate Bridge wasn't about 30 feet lower than it was. But still, I mean, why did they crash land? I mean, they didn't crash land the first time.
Well, they did, right? They did, I mean, not crash land, but they woke up not having piloted the ship down, and they were on the ground already.
No, no. No, he landed. They made a strategic reason to land in Golden Gate Park. They just woke up floating in space.
Okay, so they woke up floating. it still seemed to me that there wasn't a huge amount of control over what was happening in the, you know, in the moments after they came out of the, you know, the time warp.
Or maybe, you know, Spock's calculation might have been off, say, about a fraction of a hair, and that's why they lost control. And here we go, we're flying in blind as a bat. So, I mean, they were coming in powerless, but they did it. They now they just need to find a way to get the whales out. And so they do. Kirk sure can hold his breath for a very, very long time. While he's swimming, he's exerting himself. He's pulling on this lever. It's not going. He's got to try harder. He finally gets it, and then he's able to swim his way back up. Could you have done it?
Well, I'm no Captain Kirk.
Oh, that's so true. Yeah. You may be James, but you're not T. Kirk.
No. Missing a T. Kirk.
There you go. But it was impressive. And after a long drown out, there was another thing. Why do you think... Okay, so I see in here. Let me think here. How do I want to say this? Because I don't have that worded right. The whales, they weren't talking at the start. They were just kind of like... obviously, they were space lagged, maybe.
Yeah, that's the excuse.
Yeah, they have to be. You know, space does strange things to your body. And so they were just kind of like hanging there, not answering. And I wondered if the probe actually sensed where they were, because it seemed like the transmissions were getting more intense. Why ain't they answering? Why don't they tell them to go do with themselves? But they did. Eventually, they started to talk. And it was kind of like, yes, yes, yes. What? What do you want? And they actually did tell this probe what to go do with itself. And I thought, wow, such language. What the whale was saying? Unreal. I mean, you picked up what they were saying, right? The language they were using?
Yeah, absolutely.
They told the probe what to go do with itself, and I can't repeat it here. Okay.
I'm just surprised that the, after all that space lag, the actual, you know, George and Gracie actually got out and went, no, we're fine. You can go back.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, sure. Bye then.
Yeah, see ya.
I mean, this film is unique in the Star... Actually, maybe it's not even unique. I was about to say it's unique in the Star Trek films on the grounds that there's no antagonist. There's no villain here. I mean, the closest you get to the villain is the bureaucracy of, you know, of late 20th century San Francisco, whaling funding. Or maybe you can claim that, the humans 400 years ago were the villains, but there's no real villain here. Because I think that you can't really consider the probe to be a villain. It's just it's like a natural event that's occurring that you need to solve your way out of. So I find that strange. You would almost expect that a film with a bunch of heroes need a villain to play off against. And I think it's unique in that sense.
Okay. Well, the probe was a little upset that the whales was cursing at them and telling them where to go and what to do with themselves. So they start to leave. But good thing is they restore everybody's power. The planet, the ships, and the movie is now officially over. It's time to go on. Oh, wait, no. There are three more pressing issues. First, everyone has to get dunked into the ocean, whether they like it or not.
Yep, absolutely.
Yep. Second, we have the trial of the century, the 23rd century, that is. The charges include conspiracy, assault on Federation officer, theft of Federation property, mainly the Enterprise, sabotage of the Excelsior, destruction of property, again, the Enterprise, disobeying direct order of a Starfleet commander. So those charges don't add up to 9. I was thinking... perhaps maybe there are actually multiple counts on some charges, totaling 9.
Did they? How many Federation officers did they? I mean, I thought Sulu took out at least like three of the guys, didn't they?
No, it's just the Tiny.
Is it just Tiny?
Yeah, Kirk punches one. Tiny gets knocked out.
Okay, so that's two already then.
Yeah, Uhura puts one in the closet, so that's three.
That's three.
So maybe that all multiple charges, like three different assault charges.
And you could easily have, like, you know, multiple cases of conspiracy, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Like maybe it's one per person.
That could be. So maybe there's more than nine, but they're being generous. Matter of fact, they were definitely being generous because all except for one were summarily dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
And the one remaining was disobeying the direct orders of a Starfleet commander. And that's directed solely at Captain... Oh, Admiral. I almost gave it away. Admiral Kirk. And the punishment? No kidding. Reduced in rank to captain and given the updated and shiny new Enterprise. I don't think that's much of a discipline. I'm surprised they didn't put him in the brig for a while.
No, it clearly wasn't discipline. It was clearly a, oh, you're now going to get punished. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. You're going to be put to captain. Yeah, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And in fact, you know, you're going to be punished now because you're going to have to go and command a starship. Wink, wink.
The flagship. And we're going to put you on the spotlight because we're giving you our flagship again. You're going to keep the Enterprise. So that's pretty cool. He gets to keep the Enterprise. And considering he really hates being an admiral anyway, I guess it's no big deal.
No, absolutely not.
And the third matter is Jillian. What are we going to do with her? I think her and Kirk should run off together, but nope. She's being assigned to her own ship. A science ship, no less. And how is he going to find her? He doesn't have her phone number. But she says, don't worry, I'll find you. Which, to my knowledge, she never does. So, in the Nexus, he was talking about, what was her name? The girl that, Antonia.
Oh, wow. If you remember that, I'm impressed.
Yeah, it was Antonia that he was going to march into that bedroom and do things to her. He's never done... No, he was going to propose marriage and do things right this time. I think in that movie, it would have been great if they actually showed it was, instead of Antonia, he says Jillian. And she is there.
Isn't the issue around that, though, that they would have to pay the writers of this film for using that character?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. But the writers are Harv Bennett, and so I don't think that would have been a big deal. Okay. Oh, and last... Oh, there was one more piece of business I forgot to mention. Tell Mom I'm fine. Spock is fine. And that's it.
Yeah, it's all true.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Oh, and they have to dig out this bird of prey from the ocean as well.
I suspect they just left it there.
Ah.
As a monument. It probably would have sank, right?
Oh, yeah.
All the way to the bottom. Probably fish are living in it. It's probably a quite interesting kind of a place for a fish to live. So all the nooks and crannies, certainly since the cargo doors opened up, plenty of room.
That's true, yeah.
And it probably wouldn't change color when it rusks because it's already green.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think the ships in the future would rust. Okay.
No, perhaps not.
Okay. So is there anything I've missed?
No, I think we have been very... overly thorough. We've been very, we've gone through everything.
And while we were talking, I did try to do a couple Google searches for that pizza joint, and I can't seem to find anything on it. So my guess is it was probably a sound stage or a stage somewhere. So
did you started with pizza San Francisco, and you've been going through them one by one?
No, I asked what pizza joint was used in the movie Star Trek IV The Voyage Home, and it didn't have anything related to the pizza joint, so whatever. It's not happening. If anybody finds it, let me know. So I guess it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this movie on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. Do you want to go first, or would you like me to?
Oh, I'm happy to go first. I really enjoy this film. I think it's a lot of fun. It is kind of really weird and quirky Trek. It is kind of out there, I suppose. I can, you know, I'm happy with some of the kind of like the cheesier aspects of this. I think it's just a very nicely told story that happened to be framed, or at least you know, bookended in the Star Trek world. I think a lot of the stuff in the middle is, you know, good fish out of water stuff. You know, I'm not going to criticize it for, you know, why, how are the whales talking? What is, you know, what the hell is this all about with a big probe kind of thing? It's a part of Star Trek. You know, I wouldn't want every Star Trek film to be like this, but you know, we've had 13 of them, and for one of them to be kind of like this silly little, you know, side detour by a 1980s Earth is absolutely fine in my opinion. It's hard. Do you know what I gave Star Trek 3? Did I give that a 4? I think I must have given it a 4. This is better than Star Trek 3, in my opinion. I think it is, you know, it's a more fun film. It's a much, it's a more enjoyable film that isn't as heavy. And I think some of the failings of Star Trek 3 was that they didn't manage to achieve what they set out to achieve. But I think this film almost completely delivers what it sets out to deliver. You know, you can criticize it for not having enough action, or you can say that, you know, there wasn't any, you know, political intrigue with the Romulans, but that's not what it was trying to do from get-go. I think that assigning like a number to it is a little bit tricky. In my opinion, it's either an extremely high 4 or it's an extremely low 5. And I don't exactly know where that comes in. I'm minded at the moment to give it a 4 out of 5, just because otherwise I'll be giving everything 5s out of 5, and that's not fun for anyone. So high 4 out of 5.
Oh, okay. Search for Spock was 4 for both of us as well.
Yeah, it's better than Search for Spock. It really is. But then, does it deserve to live alongside the Ratha Khan's First Contacts, Undiscovered Countries of this world? I don't know. It's certainly the bridge between the good Trek and the great Trek.
Well,
perhaps that's the best that I can say.
You could hear all the jaws dropping of our 14 listeners and go 4.5, because you never do.
It's that, you know, down that road, it doesn't lead you anywhere. Because then I'll just get into the same discussion later on, saying, well, it's very high 4.5 compared to a very low 5.0. So I don't know what that means. And it doesn't go anywhere.
Okay. Well, let's see. I had to pull up the guest list to find out what we'd rated it, so I lost my notes here. But here we go. For me, I do love this movie a lot. I think, you know, sometimes we say that the episode is dated. It, you know, it just looks good today as it is when it was filmed. I like it. I mean, the only thing I could say that is changed from the movie from today is the cars were 1980s. Obviously, duh. But beyond that, this movie could be just as good in 15, 20 more years as it is today as it was in 1986. It's very dated sometimes, I guess. Some of the architecture is 1986. You know, there's no cell phones, really. Everybody doesn't have one. However, that's a nitpick, and, you know, don't take it serious. But I think it's a great movie. I feel very urged. What do I want to say? I want to give this a 5 because I like it. But however, I am a little put off by the obvious Greenpeace message and the plight of the whales, or maybe the overuse of nuclear energy. And I think Star Trek is the last place that should be preaching such things. But they do. I don't think Star Trek is the place to tell us that, you know, what's going to happen if whales become extinct and we need to stop that quickly. We do, that it's true, but not in Star Trek. It just doesn't make any sense.
But Star Trek is always preachy. Isn't it?
Yeah. But
Winter Star Trek.
Yeah, I know. But this, they never really took a real world thing today. I mean, I guess maybe it said space hippies are idiots. You know, that we still have space hippies. I don't know what to say about it. It just seemed like this is one of those, they decided to do a Greenpeace thing, and it just, I'm not so sure I like it. I don't know. So what would have been an alternative besides the whales and the probe coming to look for the whales? I'm not sure what could have been a better alternative. So maybe they picked the best thing they could. However, having said that, I think after the first three movies had such serious storylines that they needed to bring this one way down. So I'll accept it. Oh, let's see. I like a lot of parts of the movie, and it went along just fine. It was funny. Some of them were funnier than others, but they were just dang hilarious. So, and like you say, it's still better than Star Trek 3. So, but I do halves, as you know. I do quarters. I mean, what was a goofy one that I did? I did a 3.75. Didn't I do one silly one, like a fraction of a number or something? But anyway. Oh,
1.75 instead of fraction.
Yeah, no, I remember. It was a Star Trek The Motion Picture. I gave it a 1.99 because I just couldn't come along to a 2. So, in the end, I think this is good, but it's not absolutely perfect, so I'm good with a 4.5.
Okay. To be honest, we probably land in a very similar place.
Yeah, except for I don't have any problem with admitting that. So that's where we're at there. I don't know why Squirrel is up there barking like he is, but he is. I don't know if you can hear him.
Yeah, a little, but
yeah, that's my little chihuahua, my little lover. So, okay, so how did we end up? I don't know if we discussed this at Redemption with Brian, but with 26 episodes, in which, by the way, we had 26 guests. Loved it.
We must have more than 26 guests, because we have more than
you're right.
One person on a couple of shows.
So more like 29. But out of episodes, 26 episodes, we had 26 that had guests. And again, they still like Star Trek more than we do. The average for season 4 was 3.96 for guests. You had 3.81. And I still can't believe I do a Star Trek podcast because mine was 3.68. The guests at the beginning, I thought I would be a 5. I kind of thought, or a 4, I thought mine would be a 4, yours would be close to a 5, because you said at the beginning of season 4 that this may have been one of the best seasons in your...
I still stand by that, yeah. So maybe I'm just going to be going downhill from here.
Yeah, and I figured the guess would be a 4, so I got the guess right, close, 3.96, mine was 3.68, and yours I thought would be higher than it was, but you had... let's see, you had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 2s. Legacy, Final Mission, The Loss, Galaxy's Child, Half a Life, which, God, what's wrong with you? The Host, and you had no 1s. I had no 1s, but I did have a 1.5 for Cupid. You gave that one a 3. The guest, Carnivore J, that'd be Chris, gave it a 5.
I think some of our guests are skewing our results here.
Yeah, I think so. But like I said, you know, they come on for the episodes they like. We're doing all the episodes whether we like it or not. So obviously theirs is going to be higher. Let's see. I gave Night Terrors a 2.1. I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 2s, 2.1 or 2.5s, 1 1.5. So, I had a few episodes that I didn't like. Five fives for me. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 fives for you. So, yeah.
Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah, you definitely liked it. So, what do you think were some of the highlights of the season?
Oh, in season 4.
Yeah.
So I think that season 4, I think it has fewer kind of like highs. I mean, I'm going to say fewer highs. I've given 8 fives out. But I think that there are fewer kind of like standout episodes in season 4 that everyone goes to, whether it's Yesterday's Enterprise or Best of Both Worlds or whatever. And I think what they managed to do very well is have a lot of consistently good episodes in season 4. So, you know, I think that a lot of stuff goes back to back to back to back with kind of very high quality stuff, without there being like huge standout episodes. I think that when people talk about it, hey, what's the best episode of season 7? Everyone knows it's All Good Things, right? It's just, that's the end of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And then people will claim that the Parallels is very good. And people will, you know, there'll be a consensus around season 6 as well. And everyone will go straight to Chain of Command or something like that. I think season 4 doesn't have that as much. But I do think that they managed to keep a very good consistent show. And certainly compared to the latter seasons where in season 7 it's like, you know, Inheritance and Dark Page and Sub Rosa and stuff like that comes up much more frequently than what we have just experienced.
Okay. Let me ask you this question, and I guess I don't know if we ever did this, but our ratings came out to an average of 3.68 for me and 3.81 for you. But if you were to take the rating, if you were to rate this season 4 on our scale of 1 to 5, where would you put season 4?
Okay, very good question. Very good question. I would put it at it's a 5 out of 5 season, to be honest. And you know, you might say, well, you know, mathematically that's not what I've given it. I've given it less than the 5 out of 5. But when you tell me that I've given out 8 fives throughout the season, when you're giving out a full, you know, third of the episodes and you're rating them as 5-star episodes, you know, to me, the most you could probably get is half the episodes being 5 out of 5. So if a third are coming in at that 5 out of 5, that's really very close to what you can really expect. So certainly on the grounds that I'm not going to be doing half points, it's not a 4 out of 5 season.
Yeah.
I would be, you know, I would certainly be pushing it higher.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with you, actually. Yeah, I don't think it's a 4 as well either. So this was a damn good season compared to last season, or season 3.
Season 3 is very choppy. It's very uppy and downy.
Yeah, it does.
And that's why I say that the consistency in season 4, I think, is much more, much more notable. I think, by the way, in season 5, we start seeing the quote-unquote big episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with things like, you know, they start doing the two-parters mid-season with Unification. you know that there's, you know, certain tentpole episodes throughout the season that everyone loves, whether it's Darmok, whether it's the Inner Light, stuff like that kind of appears more and more this year rather than last. But yeah, it's certainly there's nothing at all to be, you know, ashamed about after having put out season 4.
Okay.
I mean, maybe Reunion or something like that.
Yeah. So I agree with you. I would give season 4 a 5 as well. It's a very good, very good. So, okay. Well, anything else you want to discuss? Or
no, I think not really. Is it when does this go out? Or what are our listeners going to expect next?
Well, there was a little bit that I need to edit. I don't know. I don't remember where it was that I had that long pause there as I was trying to figure out. I don't know. I might leave all that stuff in and just let people fast forward. But we recorded this on Thursday, April 27th. So you get an idea of when I put this out.
No, but I mean, what's the next episode they're going to hear? Are they going to hear Darmok next? Or?
Oh, yes. Yes, Darmok.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it will be Darmok. Because, Darmok is already edited and ready to go. I actually have the file created. I just didn't want to, because at the end of Redemption, I said to, you know, come back for the voyage home. So I thought it'd be better to wait. So we'll get Darmok next week. Since it's already ready, I can already put it on the WordPress blog and have it go out. So, hey guys, I got a challenge for you. Since Darmok won't be going out for a week or two, you figure out our file scheme, maybe you can download it before it posts.
So you're inviting hackers?
Yes. Yes. Oh. Try and figure out, because I would like to see if Blueberry and Tech Podcasts show downloads for a post that hasn't even gone out yet. So in other words, if you could figure out our filing scheme, which is very easy to do, by the way, if I get that file up before I put this post on, then you should be able to figure it out. If you made it this far into this episode or into this review and you want to try and catch the Darmok before it goes out, go for it. I'd love to see that. Challenge. Challenged.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Well, good. But while you're there, please don't delete anything.
Yeah, right. No, I won't. So, yeah, well, they can't delete anything. They could just, if they could predict where the file is and what the file name is going to be, and it shouldn't be hard based on the way I've done them for the last 4 years, 4 seasons, I should say. They'll be able to do it. They'll be able to just download it. They can't change anything. Unless Mark Stamper gets pissed at us and deletes our whole show. But I don't think that's going to happen, I hope.
A savage kidnapping.
You're holding our captain. I want him released.
And Picard is forced to play a dangerous game of survival.
No!
Now there is only one way to bring him back alive.
And it's going to take me at least a full day to do it.
Captain Picard could be dead by then.
And it could lead to a full-scale war.
Stand by to fire, Mr. Worf.
We cannot survive another hit.
Deadly Encounter on another exciting episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
So everyone, join us next time as we review the already reviewed episode 2 of The Next Generation season 5. And that is, as we said, called Darmok. And oh, I gave the secret sauce away, didn't I? I said we already recorded that and it's already put together. Ooh.
Mm-hmm. You did.
Oh, well. It's like I've never done that before. I won't say anything about Ensign Row. All right. Everyone take care and good night.
Good night. Mm-hmm.